Next day, the American nemesis, Nisshin, was sent out on another reinforcement run. But with an enemy carrier out there somewhere, the damage done by American flyers from Guadalcanal the previous day, and no air cover available for her, the Nisshin was called back. It was another fringe benefit of the otherwise ineffective attacks of October 5th. But while the seaplane carrier was called back, the destroyers were not, and the Shigure led the Ayanami, Fubuki, and Murakumo on another successful run that night. The Americans simply could not stop these rat transportation runs. However, the Americans could and did stop the ant runs, for a while anyway. The Japanese had been trying to run barges from Shortland to Rendova to carry heavy weapons and supplies, but the barges were not exactly seagoing creatures, and even struggled in the littorals. Then the Americans attacked one of the intermediate bases for the barge runs. The ant transportation had to be suspended, which put more pressure on the Imperial Navy supply convoys, and especially the Nisshin. The Nisshin's delay was only a day, likely so they could get the new anti-aircraft destroyer, Akizuki, to escort her. Now, with the Harusami, Natsugumu, Asagumu, and Yudachi, as well as the Akizuki shepherding her, the Nisshin set out from Shortland on October 8th, carrying 6 anti-aircraft guns, 2 howitzers, and 180 troops. The destroyers carried an additional 560 troops. They successfully landed them that night. There was no trouble until the way back, although the Nisshin endured a bombing attack but took no damage. The next Tokyo Express run was a milestone. The old light cruiser Tatsuta and destroyers Shikinami, Hayashio, Nowaki, Kuroshio, Oyashio, Akigumo, and Uranami were carrying 400 naval infantry of the 4th Maizuru Naval Landing Force, 700 Imperial Army troops, and General Yakutake himself, finally making his appearance on the front lines. Before he left Rabaul for Guadalcanal, General Yakutake said, "The operation to surround and recapture Guadalcanal will truly decide the fate of the Pacific War." That still did not make the operation important enough for Yakutake to fully commit the fresh 38th Nagoya Division. He was saving as much of that division as he could for the new offensive in New Guinea. General Yakutake arrived to find that the Japanese had just been driven from the Matanako River defense line by a splitting attack engineered by General Vandegrift that virtually wiped out the 4th Regiment. Yakutake also found out that many of the troops, especially those of the Kawaguchi detachment, were starving. The 17th Army commander ordered new reinforcement convoys halted in favor of supply convoys. The supplies were so badly needed that Yakutake wanted the convoys sent whether or not the Lunga airfield was suppressed. But Admiral Yamamoto had no intention of allowing that to happen. The next run of the seaplane carrier Nisshin would include a strong escort of an entire division of heavy cruisers, and the admiral was working on an idea that had intrigued him for some time. He had promised Colonel Tsuji that if necessary, he would bring the Yamato to Guadalcanal and blast the airfield. Imperial General Headquarters had put a stop to that. Why send the biggest, most powerful battleship in the world to the front line when it can more usefully sit in the middle of Truk Harbor like a floating hotel with Yamamoto sitting on the floor of his stateroom writing haiku? No, the Yamato and her sister, Musashi, would not be going to Guadalcanal, but the Japanese had other battleships. Chapter 8 I Am Aoba. Normally, when one wants to protect something, one tries to surround it with something else. If surrounding the object to be protected is not possible, one tries to at least place something between the object and whatever could threaten it. But the Imperial Japanese Navy was not always normal. The Imperial Navy had a peculiar habit of having the escorting ships hang out well behind the slow, unarmored, almost defenseless transports filled with troops. It made sense in a way. If the enemy showed up blocking the transports, the enemy could cut these ships to pieces and kill the troops on board, but the warships would be all right. It seemed to work at the Battle of the Java Sea, which was at its core an attempt by Allied ships to intercept a Japanese invasion convoy. The Japanese commander in charge of protecting the transports, Admiral Takagi Takeo, had decided having his cruisers some 200 miles behind the defenseless ships was good enough. And it was, until Allied ships showed up. Then, in a panic that his subordinates found amusing, Takagi had the cruisers race up to place themselves between the transports and the Allies. He arrived just in time, when the Allied ships were only some 20 miles from the convoy. In that respect, the battle was a near-run thing. The Battle of the Java Sea was hardly the only time the Imperial Navy did not take protecting army transports seriously. Just 2 nights later, off the Sunda Strait, the U.S. cruiser Houston and Australian cruiser Perth managed to sneak into an anchorage filled with Japanese transports, getting between the transports and their guarding warships, because those guarding warships were out to sea, trying to intercept fleeing Allied ships. Arrogant, overconfident, sloppy. Arrogant and overconfident might also be used to describe Vice Admiral Tsukahara, head of the Southeast Area and the 11th Air Fleet. He had demonstrated that he was something of a hothead, too, figuratively speaking. Recently, however, Tsukahara had been a hothead literally, as he was suffering from dengue fever, malaria, and dysentery. Rabaul was not much better than Guadalcanal in terms of health effects. So on October 8th, Admiral Tsukahara relinquished command of the Southeast Area and the 11th Air Fleet to Vice Admiral Kusaka Jinichi, cousin to Admiral Nagumo's infamously cautious chief of staff, Rear Admiral Kusaka Ryunosuke. Meanwhile, the Buin airfield was completed, finally, at the southern end of Bougainville. The Americans would call it Kahili. On October 10th, the 6th Air Group completed staging into it. The 6th had the Mitsubishi A6M3 Model 320, the Allies would initially call it the HAMP, which had squared-off wings and, despite being newer than the A6M2 Model 21 Zeke Zero, had a far shorter range, which had restricted it to defending Rabaul. No longer. From Buin, the Model 32s could both protect the Shortlands Base Complex and reach Guadalcanal. Now Base Air Force could attack Guadalcanal twice a day. Base Air Force could also cover the reinforcement convoys. Admiral Jojima's reinforcement group departed Shortland, centered on seaplane carriers Nishin and Chitose, carrying a total of 4 150mm howitzers with towing vehicles, 2 field guns, 1 anti-aircraft gun, and 280 troops of the Sendai Division, plus supplies. They were escorted by destroyers Asagumo, Natsugumo, Yamagumo, Shirayuki, Murakumo, and Akizuki, who were also carrying 289 naval infantry of the 4th Maizuru Special Navy Landing Force, 410 army troops, a regimental gun, 2 battalion guns, 2 rapid-fire guns, and a mortar. It was said that Jojima could navigate a warship even on dry land. It was a skill that might very well be needed before this campaign was over. To cover Admiral Jojima, Base Air Force tried its new idea to wear down the Cactus Air Force. At 9:10 a.m., 18 zeros of the Tainan Air Group under Lieutenant Commander Nakajima took off from Rabaul. 2 soon aborted, but the remaining 16 were to perform a fighter sweep of the Lunga airfield. Following them by 45 minutes was a second strike led by Misawa Air Group Lieutenant Commander Uchida Tomoyuki with 45 Mitsubishi G4Ms, 18 from the 751 Air Group and 9 each from the Kisarazu, Misawa, and 753 Air Groups, escorted by 29 Zeros, 12 from the 3rd Air Group, 9 from the 751, and 8 from the 2nd, under Lieutenant Ito. That is, 90 aircraft were headed for Guadalcanal. The idea was for the first strike to scare up American fighters, then the second strike would catch them on the ground refueling after the first strike. With no warning from coast watchers, Lunga radar picked up the 2 formations inbound, 138 miles to the northwest. The Cactus Air Force sent up 15 Wildcats from Marine Fighting 121, 16 from Marine Fighting 223, and 8 from the Saratoga, followed by 12 Era Cobras. Heavy cloud cover created confusion, in which the American fighters became scattered. Around 1 p.m., Lieutenant Commander Nakajima's 16 Zeros ended up wrestling with 8 Fighting 121 F-4Fs under Major Leonard Davis. Petty Officer First Class Nishizawa Hiroyoshi gouged the Grumman of Second Lieutenant Arthur Neff, forcing him to ditch offshore. All 16 Zeros returned safely. About 45 minutes later came the second strike, just slightly too early to catch the American fighters on the ground. Heavy clouds again confused the action. Unable to find the airfields, most of the G4Ms turned back, but the 18 Type 1s of the 751 Air Group under Lieutenant Commander Nishioka Kazuo ducked under the clouds to bomb the airfields. They hadn't found the airfields either, and almost all the bombs landed several miles southeast of Fighter One. Many of the Marine Wildcats had been low on fuel and about to land, but made one pass anyway, damaging four Bettys, with one later written off. Another, that of Petty Officer First Class Tashiro Abu, was crippled, then chased down and destroyed by Captain William C. Sharpstein, flying a P-39-era Cobra of the 339th Fighter Squadron. In turn, Army First Lieutenant Howard Stern was killed when his era Cobra was shot down. In short, the new double-strike tactic of Base Air Force had failed, but it might have succeeded if not for those meddling clouds. Admiral Kusaka was not willing to give up on this idea quite yet. It was not the only experiment currently underway. Admiral Jojima's reinforcement group was assigned air cover in the form of flights of 6 zeros each that rotated throughout the day. The last flight was ordered to stay on station until after sunset. Then, unable to make for Buin in the dark, the pilots were expected to ditch their zeros in the slot and be picked up by destroyers. The Japanese got it half right. The pilots, all from the 6th Air Group, ditched their zeros as ordered, but five of the pilots were never seen again. It was a small but telling unforced error, further eroding the rapidly dwindling number of Sea Eagles. Also speeding toward Guadalcanal to assist the reinforcement group was the so-called bombardment group, consisting of the truncated 6th Cruiser Division and two destroyers, whose job was to bombard Guadalcanal. This little force was sailing under the command of Rear Admiral Goto Aritomo. Goto had spent almost his entire career at sea, with little in the way of staff or shore postings. That seagoing experience had made him an accomplished, respected expert in torpedo tactics, which in turn helped earn him command of the 6th Cruiser Division. Then again, the lack of staff or shore postings may have denied Goto the political connections needed to get something better than the 6th, which was not necessarily a first-line command, consisting of four older, undergunned heavy cruisers of the almost identical Aoba and Kako classes. But Goto had made the most of it, and the 6th had performed extremely well in the ambush of Savo Island. Extremely well, at least until the admiral started the victory celebration a wee bit early and discontinued his ship's anti-submarine protocols as they approached port. Now the 6th had only three cruisers of the almost identical Aoba and Kako classes, and the Kako was not one of them, having paid the ultimate price for not maintaining vigilance. Perhaps that incident gave Admiral Goto his first misgivings about the entire Guadalcanal operation. He had shared his reservations with Admiral Tanaka that perhaps their bosses were not taking this campaign seriously enough. There his reservations remained. Goto was a colorful old sea dog and far from stupid. He knew further criticism could be career-ending. But his reservations were in the wind on this October 11th. The Americans had never contested by sea a transport mission at night. There was no consideration that they would do so this night, and Admiral Goto's ships were ready. He had had them practicing shore bombardment since September. By 6:12 p.m., his force was in the center route to Guadalcanal, one of the Japanese names for the slot, some 120 miles northwest of Guadalcanal, on a course of 110 degrees true, east-southeast, and a speed of 22 knots, soon increased to 30 knots. They were dealing with intermittent squalls that the admiral found most annoying, though in theory they helped cover his approach. Goto had his ships in a T-shaped formation, the heavy cruisers Aoba, Furutaka, and Kinugasa in a central column, destroyer Fubuki, 3,300 yards to port of Aoba, and destroyer Hatsuyuki, 3,300 yards to starboard. At 10:20 p.m., the Nishin signaled the reinforcement group had reached the landing zone on Guadalcanal, where no enemy ships were present. 20 minutes later, Admiral Goto received a message that the weather over Guadalcanal was fair. After another half hour, Goto's aide, Captain Kijima Kikunori, noted continuous spurts of heat lightning to starboard, but they carried no thunder, though there were more squalls. A little before 11:30, the navigator reported Savo Island was 20 miles ahead and would be visible in half an hour. The heat lightning and showers had dissipated. The Aoba skipper, Captain Hisamune Sojiro, turned to Admiral Goto and said, "Admiral, lookouts report flickering lights dead ahead." The admiral wasn't worried. "It could be the reinforcement group," Goto responded. "Answer them. Find out what they want." The Aoba flashed a recognition signal, following the common practice of first identifying herself. I am Aoba. There was no answer. They tried again. I am Aoba. Again, no answer. The lack of a response was reported to Admiral Goto. Though some of the cruiser's bridge were suspicious, to the admiral it was a curiosity, nothing more. Goto told Captain Hisamune to hold course, steady on course 125 degrees. The Aoba came out of another rain squall at 11:40 p.m. About to enter more restricted waters at night with a darkened target, Admiral Goto ordered speed cut to 26 knots. A lookout reported three ships dead ahead at a distance of 11,000 yards, about 5 miles. They had to be the reinforcement group unloading troops and equipment on Guadalcanal, just as they were supposed to. Just as she was supposed to, the flagship used her Aldus lamp to identify herself to the friendly ships by flashing the recognition signal, I am Aoba. The range to the ships ahead closed to 7,000 yards, with no response to the recognition signal. Stunned lookouts yelled that those ships were actually enemy. Enemy? Couldn't be, Admiral Goto thought. No enemy ships were reported in this area. The flagship's Aldus lamp flashed again, I am Aoba. Admiral Goto leaned on the polished wood railing atop the starboard bridge bulkhead, watching the heat lightning that had returned just off the port bow. Strange. It was silent, like heat lightning often is, but this wasn't the white flashes in the clouds you'd normally expect. Instead, it was orange flashes, close to the water. Those weren't lightning flashes. Those were gun flashes. The reinforcement group must have mistaken his ships for the enemy. Admiral Goto was being targeted by his own forces. Put your rudder over. Reverse course, Admiral Goto shouted to Captain Hisamune. The order went out in plain language over the voice radio to the other ships. The gunfire was coming from almost dead ahead, but slightly to port. Best to turn away from it. Battle stations were not ordered. The gunfire was obviously a horrible mistake. Goto was not going to compound it by shooting at his own ships. Instead, the Japanese flagship tried to stop the gunfire by identifying herself. Exasperated signalmen flashed the Aldus lamp again. I am Aoba! The flagship heeled over as she turned to starboard, presenting her broadside to the guns now targeting her. A storm of shells battered the Aoba. At least one cut into the cruiser's flag bridge. It did not explode, but its momentum created enough shrapnel to cut down most of the bridge crew. Admiral Goto was knocked to the deck, badly wounded. Captain Kijima carried his admiral below decks for treatment and comfort, but Admiral Goto's wounds were mortal. As Goto Aritomo slowly slipped away, Captain Kijima tried to console him as best he could. He told Goto that he could die with an easy mind because they had sunk two American heavy cruisers. The admiral was not assuaged. Painfully, Goto Aritomo growled at the men who had ended his life, Bakayaro, which might be most politely translated as stupid bastards. Captain Kijima went back to the shattered bridge. He had lied to his admiral. The same salvo that had wounded his admiral had slashed communications, knocked out the fire director, and disabled the forward main battery before it could fire a shot. But Goto Aritomo would not, could not, accept Kijima's explanation. Kijima knew, and the other skippers in the task force knew, what the admiral refused to see. The ships shooting at them were not from the reinforcement group, not even Japanese. They were from the U.S. Navy. Much like Admiral Goto, Rear Admiral Norman Scott believed he was shooting at his own ships. He was frantic. He had destroyers out there, he knew not where, and he had not even ordered his ships to open fire. Norman Scott was a survivor of the Battle of Tsavo Island, if a distant survivor. He had been in Tsavo Sound that horrid August night, on board his then flagship light anti-aircraft cruiser San Juan, commanding a group that also included the Australian light cruiser Hobart and American destroyers Monson and Buchanan. Scott had not been involved in the combat, though, but he had studied all the information that could be gleaned from the Battle of Tsavo Island. Admiral Scott was determined that such a disaster would not happen again, not on his watch. And Scott now had a chance to put his studies into practice. On September 20th, Admiral Gormley had given command of the screening and attack force to Scott, taking over for Admiral Wright. Norman Scott was ready for battle. Scott had been one of the best-liked men in the class of 1911 at the Naval Academy. He had done a tour of duty in the office of the Chief of Naval Operations, but made everyone's life miserable because he wanted to be at sea. He got his wish. As commander of this still new task force, Admiral Scott had established a reputation as kind of like a junior Halsey. The popular Scott was ready for battle. We're his men. We would talk about it constantly, said Chick Morris of the light cruiser Helena. The talk was always of the impending clash with the enemy's warships. Were we good enough? None of us knew. We had never been through the real thing. Scott aimed to make them good enough. In theory, Admiral Scott's force was to have 6 cruisers and 9 destroyers. In practice, it never had this many ships, and was filled with whatever cruisers and destroyers could be spared or were no longer needed to escort the Enterprise, Saratoga, and Wasp. These few ships were pulled this way and that, hither and yon in various duties, but whenever they had a free moment, during those last few weeks of September and the first week of October, Scott made sure they got in a lot of gunnery practice, and a lot of practice in what Marine gunner Private Clifford Spencer on the heavy cruiser San Francisco called Night Fighting Course 101. For the next 2 weeks, we held daily gunnery practice and high-speed night tactical maneuvers every night, all night, recalled Spencer. We were at general quarters every night and had mock battles with opposing ships, all moving at flank speed. Some fun. But Spencer was not complaining. The object of the practice was to have everyone sharpen their night vision and spot the enemy before he saw you. With training, helmsmen were able to maintain ship intervals with more expertise and direct more energy to finding the enemy ships, allowing you to get off those very important first salvos. There is no substitute for combat experience, but relentless training can help one survive that first combat experience, replacing fear with procedure, instinct, muscle memory. Admiral Scott had to instill behavior into his ships and crews that the Japanese had perfected over many years. The Admiral had days, or at best a few weeks. We bitched and probably whined a lot, but by God we learned. This was how Admiral Scott earned the respect and the love of the men under his command. It was exhausting. It was dangerous. During one exercise on September 30th, the San Francisco collided with a mine layer, Breeze, which in a time not much earlier would have cost a skipper his command. But his men knew Scott was preparing them for survival. In Texas, the battle cry had been, "Remember the Alamo." Here the rally cry was, "Remember Salvo Island," remembered Spencer. In the interim, Admiral Gormley had put his plans to seize an airfield site on Ndene on hold again, so he could send infantry reinforcements directly to Guadalcanal. These infantry were not Marines, but U.S. Army. In the early months of 1942, Admiral King had compelled a generally unwilling U.S. Army to send troops to New Caledonia because it was specifically listed in the Arcadia Declaration as part of the main air routes which must be secured by securing essential air bases. The Army found some loose units here and there, totaling some 17,000 troops, and sent them to Noumea in a secret convoy that arrived in March, where General Patch set up headquarters for the defense of New Caledonia. Those loose units were arranged into a full Army division, one without the standard numerical designation, for now anyway. Private First Class David Fonseca of the 26th Signal Company suggested a contraction of America and Caledonia. Thus, the Americal Division was born, the only U.S. Army division formed outside United States territory. Now one of those previously loose units, the 164th Infantry Regiment, was to be deployed to Guadalcanal as the vanguard of the Americal Division. The regiment, along with 210 men of the 1st Marine Air Wing and supplies for the 1st Marine Division, was loaded onto the transport Zeilen and Admiral Turner's flagship transport Macaulay on October 8th. The next day they sailed from Noumea with a close escort of destroyers Gwyn, Nicholas, and Storet, and 3 mine layers. Providing air cover was the only operational American carrier left in the Pacific, the Hornet, while protecting the right flank was a task force centered on the only operational American battleship left in the Pacific, the Washington. It fell to Admiral Scott's ships to cover the left flank of the transports. On October 7th, Scott left Espiritu Santo with only the heavy cruisers San Francisco, his flagship, and Salt Lake City, light cruiser Boise, and destroyers Fahrenholt, Buchanan, and Laffey. His orders were to go to a spot near Rennell Island and wait. When air reconnaissance showed Japanese ships moving toward Guadalcanal, Scott would take his ships to the Savo Island area to intercept them. Scott's specific mission was to search for and destroy enemy ships and landing craft. That was fine with the aggressive, confident Scott. It was not fine with Admiral Gormley, who understandably regarded Scott's force as too small for this mission. So the light cruiser Helena and the destroyers Duncan and McCalla were found near Espiritu Santo and ordered to join Scott's force. Ever conscious of the lessons of Savo Island, Admiral Scott held one last night battle practice on October 8th. The next day, Scott issued his preliminary battle plan. It incorporated as many of the lessons of Savo Island as he could. A huge issue at Savo had been the mistaken belief that they were under fire from friendly ships, so Admiral Scott placed a premium on identification. Both for that reason, and because many of the ships had not worked together before, Scott decided to keep a simple column formation. The cruisers would be in the center, with the destroyers in front and back. It was hoped this formation would improve communications and identification. The destroyers were to illuminate targets as soon as possible after radar contacts, to launch torpedoes at large ships, and fire their guns at enemy destroyers. The destroyers in the lead were reminded to be alert for turn signals by voice radio or blinker, and to watch for turns if the voice radio failed. As for the cruisers, the heavy cruisers were to use continuous fire against small ships at short range, rather than full gun salvos with long intervals. This was standard operating procedure for the U.S. Navy, but it essentially constantly advertised the ship's position with the continuous gun flashes. The cruisers Salt Lake City and the Helena were, with the destroyers, to keep watch on the disengaged side. The cruisers were to open fire without orders from Admiral Scott. Again with the identification issue, ships compelled to fall out of formation were to do so on the disengaged side and head to Tulagi if unable to make 15 knots. A ship becoming separated from the formation was not to rejoin until after requesting permission, giving bearing of approach in voice code. The Admiral also borrowed liberally from the Japanese side. If the Japanese resorted to illuminating with searchlights, the Americans were to counter-illuminate, a military word if there ever was one. Admiral Scott figured that if the Japanese could use float planes, so could the Americans. Each cruiser was to launch two float planes to scout the shore for enemy landings and the sound for enemy ships. The aircraft was to maintain contact with the enemy until the approach of the task force, then to drop bombs and float lights to indicate the enemy's position. Planes were to report any information regarding the enemy, even if there wasn't any. Flares were not to be used unless expressly ordered by the Admiral. Upon the completion of their mission, or in the event that tactical scouting was impossible, the planes were to land at Tulagi. Admiral Scott had tried to think of everything. It was as complete a plan as was possible, and was certainly reasonable under the circumstances, but it wasn't perfect. One problem was radar, that new device whose potential most in the U.S. Navy did not understand, including, despite his best efforts, Admiral Scott. That was especially true of the new SG search radar, the type of radar with the overhead display that most resembles radar as it is known today. All of the cruisers carried radar, but only light cruisers Boise and Helena carried the new SG search radar. Yet Scott, as admirals traditionally did, chose as his flagship what he believed was his strongest ship, the heavy cruiser San Francisco. However, both the San Francisco and the Salt Lake City, the latter with her 10 8-inch guns, arguably more powerful than the former with 9, each carried the SC radar, whose display looked more like an EKG and required interpretation through a top-secret decoder ring or something. Worse, radio intelligence had determined that the Japanese could detect SC radar transmissions because of its wide metric band. Scott ordered the SC radar switched off during transit, restricting use to the centrometric SG radar and the even narrower band fire control radars. The Admiral was going to have to get his contact information from the Boise and Helena instead of seeing it himself. And then there were the torpedoes. For some time, U.S. Navy submarines had strongly suspected there were serious mechanical problems with their torpedo, the Mark 14. The Bureau of Ordnance denied any problems. Then Admiral King got involved. Shortly thereafter, in late August, a notice had been issued that tests had proven the torpedoes were running some 10 feet deeper than set. Because the Navy had been too cash-strapped to test the torpedoes with actual warheads, and instead used dummy warheads, which were lighter than real warheads, the torpedo's depth setting had been calibrated incorrectly. Once the depth issue was identified, the problem was relatively easy to fix. But the problems did not end there. The Mark 14 would be detonated by the Mark 6 exploder, which included a contact exploder and a magnetic influence feature. This feature was intended to cause the torpedo to detonate when it entered a ship's magnetic field, which in theory was when the torpedo was under the ship. In theory. However, the size of the magnetic field varied depending on where one was on the Earth. So the magnetic field of a ship off, say, Newport, Rhode Island, home of the U.S. Navy's Newport Torpedo Station, was of a different size and shape than the magnetic field of a ship off, for instance, Guadalcanal. Since the beginning of the war, the submariners had reported a never-ending stream of premature explosions and non-explosions from its torpedoes. They were suspicious something was wrong with the Mark VI, especially that magnetic influence exploder, but the Navy Bureau of Ordnance and the Newport Torpedo Station refused to even consider the matter and blamed the malfunctions on user error. The Navy's destroyers usually did not launch their torpedoes under the slow and carefully documented conditions that submarines did, so they could not know for sure. But they had escaped success with their torpedo, the Mark 15, which also used the Mark 6. As it was, a month earlier, the skipper of the destroyer Lansdowne, Lieutenant Commander Smedberg, had to deactivate the magnetic influence feature in order to get his Mark 15 torpedoes to actually sink the blazing carrier Wasp. The Mark 6 was supposed to be a wonder weapon. So far, its users were only left wondering. Meanwhile, Admiral Scott was wondering when the enemy would show up. On the afternoons of October 9th and 10th, Scott's force positioned itself near Rennell Island to be able to make the 20 to 25 knot dash to arrive off Savo Island by 11 p.m. But there were no sightings, and each night Scott went back south again. He flew off four of his cruiser floatplanes to Tulagi, where they would spend the evening and return the next afternoon. This was about the time, 1:45 p.m., that an 11th Bombardment Group B-17 reported two cruisers and six destroyers some 210 miles from Guadalcanal heading down the slot at 25 knots on a course 120 degrees true, southeast. Admiral Scott plotted their course and speed. They would arrive off Guadalcanal at about 11 p.m. At 4:07 p.m., Scott got his ships moving toward Savo Island. The cruisers were in a column, the flagship San Francisco in front, followed by the Boise, Salt Lake City, and Helena. In front of the column was a 2,500-yard semicircle of destroyers, with the McCalla and Buchanan to port, the Fahrenholt dead ahead, and the Duncan and Laffey to starboard. The impending action gave Admiral Scott an aerial tangle. He had ordered his cruisers to send off all but one of their floatplanes to Tulagi, which they started to do around 4 p.m. However, this was when the floatplanes they had sent the day before started returning, pursuant to their previous orders. Scott wanted to send them back, but they were suffering from contaminated gasoline and had to be taken aboard. While being hoisted aboard, the San Francisco's floatplane bounced off the hull and was damaged. Scott ordered the Buchanan to recover the crew and sink the plane, which delayed the destroyer rejoining the formation until 10 p.m. and possibly complicated the night battle plan. The U.S. Navy just could not get the hang of floatplanes. Another report of the enemy had come in at 6:10 p.m., this from Cactus Air Force SPDs. Again, it was two enemy cruisers and six destroyers, speed 20 knots, again on course 120 degrees true, now some 110 miles from Guadalcanal. Were these the same ships reported earlier? It seems so. Were these the only ships coming? No other sightings had been reported. Admiral Scott ordered his ships to battle stations, mainly as a precaution. He didn't expect combat for another 5 hours or so, and that combat was to be with an invasion convoy with unarmed and lightly armed transports. For that reason, 4 hours later, Admiral Scott started putting his ships in a combat state of mind. The floatplanes were to be launched at 10 p.m., and at the appointed hour, the Salt Lake City, Boise, and San Francisco catapulted theirs into the air. The Helena did not receive Scott's order to launch the floatplane. Her skipper, Captain Gilbert Hoover, was unwilling to leave the fire hazard aboard in a night combat action, and so dumped it over the side. Meanwhile, just after the Salt Lake City's floatplane was blasted into the air, improperly stowed flares kept on board ignited. The plane immediately crashed, leaving a ring of fire that burned for 2 minutes about 600 yards off the starboard side of the column. The hideous nature of the fire convinced the American witnesses that no one could have survived, but both crew members did. Not to be outdone, 90 minutes later the floatplane from the Boise developed engine trouble and had to plop down near Tulagi, where, without power, she had to bob in the water waiting for rescue. The U.S. Navy still could not get the hang of floatplanes. The Americans were very fortunate that Admiral Jojima's ships, hidden by a jut of land, missed the fire, and even more fortunate that Admiral Goto, who did see the fire, concluded it was some sort of message from Jojima's ships, and still more fortunate in the judgment of Commander Yokota Minoru, whose submarine, I-26, rapidly becoming an American nemesis, had spotted a cruiser at 10:26 p.m. southwest of Guadalcanal. An Allied ship approaching Guadalcanal at night was very unusual, so Yokota decided he would report the contact after attacking it. He had his boat dive and approach the cruiser column, but struggled to get into attack position. Admiral Scott's American Surprise was still safe, for now. Around 10:30, when the force was 23 miles southeast of Savo Island, the force changed course to 75 degrees true, east-northeast, heading directly toward Savo. A few minutes later, Admiral Scott ordered the five destroyers to go to battle formation, join the cruiser column, which Captain Robert G. Tobin, head of Destroyer Squadron 12, acknowledged. His command ship, Fahrenholt, moved in front, followed by Duncan and Laffey, while the Buchanan moved behind the Helena and the McCalla moved behind the Buchanan, forming a column 3 miles long. At 10:50, Lieutenant John A. Thomas, in the San Francisco's floatplane, reported, "One large, two small vessels, 1 6 miles from Savo off Northern Beach, Guadalcanal, will investigate closer." The report was not well understood, aboard the San Francisco's flag bridge. 1 6? What does that mean? 16? Or one ship 6 miles from Savo Island? What does large mean? A battleship? Are these ships moving? Right on schedule, at 11 p.m., Commodore Tobin's destroyer Fahrenholt, in the lead, sighted Savo Island dead ahead. Admiral Scott changed course to 50 degrees true to assume a blocking position west of Savo, with a clean horizon for radar searches to avoid the land interference that had complicated things at the Savo Island disaster in August. The column of American ships kept steaming along, trying to keep the gap between Savo Island and Guadalcanal plugged. At 11:30, Lieutenant Thomas in the San Francisco's floatplane reported, "One large ship, two small ships, 16 miles east of Savo, 1 mile offshore." A slightly more coherent report. As the ships assumed battle formation, the tension aboard the ships ratcheted up, especially for the vast majority of the men for whom this was going to be their first combat. On the destroyer Duncan, Bosun's mate Third Class Roy Boehm, manning the number 2 5-inch mount, was watching for targets. Another gunner was nervously pacing through the mount's entrance hatch. "See anything yet?" the gunner muttered. "Yes," Boehm responded. There was a moment of apprehensive silence from the gunner. Then he asked the obvious. "What do you see?" "The dark." "Boehm, I don't want any of your bullshit tonight," grumbled the gunner. On the Boise, radar technician Vincent Langello said several prayers, including the Lord's Prayer, and a reasonable facsimile of the 23rd Psalm. He observed, "All over the ship, the men braced themselves for action. They were like tigers, crouched backward, ready to leap at their prey." As the Boise and the rest of the column scooched more and more to the northeast, it opened up a gap between it and Guadalcanal that would only get wider and wider. Admiral Scott had to turn around and head back to the southwest to keep the blocking position and keep that gap plugged. All his ships had to do was turn around. In all of the training through which Scott had put his ships, they had never practiced this maneuver, not at night. But how hard could it be? So at 11:32 p.m., when 4 miles off Savo Island, Admiral Scott radioed, "Signal, execute to follow. Column left a course 230. He was telling his ships to prepare for a course change. In naval parlance, when an admiral commanding a fleet orders a turn, it means all the ships so ordered are to change to the same course at the same time. It can be called a simultaneous turn, but there are other versions of this term used for clarity. If a group of ships is steaming line ahead, that is, in a column, a simultaneous turn will put the ships in a line abreast formation, that is, a line, so it can be called a line turn, while an echelon turn staggers the turn, so the ships steam in the same direction, but with each ship at an angle from the other ships in the formation. But if a group of ships are in a column and are expected to turn and follow the leader, the turn is called a column movement, though perhaps column turn might be better for clarity. The column of ships becomes like a train or a centipede. The lead ship goes to a spot on the water and turns and moves on. The next ship follows the first ship to the same spot, turns in the same direction, and moves on following the first, and so forth. The order to actually turn, the column movement, came by voice radio. Execute column left to course 230. In the Fahrenhold in front, Commodore Tobin had the destroyer turn to port to assume course 230 degrees true southwest. The Fahrenhold was followed by the Duncan and the Laffey. Commodore Tobin looked at the cruisers who were behind him in the column, or were supposed to be, because the San Francisco, Admiral Scott's flagship, had turned at the same time the Fahrenhold did. The flagship had not followed the destroyers ahead of her, but had cut inside them, and the other cruisers were following the San Francisco. Tobin's three destroyers were cut out of the formation. A bemused Tobin wondered if he had misinterpreted the order. Were the lead destroyers, the cruisers, and the trailing destroyers supposed to execute column turns by group, so that the trailing destroyers would be ahead? Were his ships supposed to be cut out? He later reported, at 23:32, force reverse course left to 230 degrees true, cruisers executing column movement immediately. Fahrenhold turned to left, followed by Duncan and Laffey. I gave orders to the captain of the Fahrenhold to slow as necessary to remain astern of the cruisers until it could be ascertained whether DDs, destroyers, which had been in the rear, were following cruisers in formation or had turned to take new van positions. It was not his fault, nor was it Admiral Scott's fault. Not anyone's fault, really. But San Francisco had only one voice radio for the talk between ships' frequencies. That radio was on the flag bridge, not the navigation bridge, where the cruiser's skipper, Captain Charles H. McMorris, was. Despite being Scott's flag captain, McMorris had not received Scott's full order. As soon as Commodore Tobin saw that the trailing destroyers, Buchanan and McCalla, were following the cruisers, he had his three destroyers race up the starboard side of the cruiser column, intending to take the lead once again. The force was thrown into confusion, just as the Japanese showed up. In reality, they had shown up a little earlier. At 11:25, the SG radar on the Helena picked up unidentified contacts on a bearing of 315 degrees true at the extreme range of 28,000 yards. The contact was updated and plotted every 15 seconds. For whatever reason, news of the contact never reached Admiral Scott. A minute later, the Salt Lake City's SC radar, operating against orders, picked up unidentified ships on bearing 273 degrees true 16,000 yards away. They were heading on a course of 120 degrees true at a speed of about 20 knots. The radar operators on the Salt Lake City guessed that the 20-knot speed was probably too slow for aircraft. For whatever reason, news of this contact never reached Admiral Scott either. At 11:38 p.m., it was the SG radar on the Boise that picked up unidentified ships bearing 295 degrees true, range of about 14,000 yards. Again, a report of this contact never reached Admiral Scott. It was not until 11:41, 16 minutes after her radar initially detected enemy ships, that the Helena reported to Admiral Scott a surface radar contact bearing 298. The range would have been helpful. So would course and speed. The San Francisco trained out her fire control radar toward this target, and the Helena's report was repeated to the other ships. Another 2 minutes, and it was the Boise that was reporting in, this time, five bogeys bearing 065. Admiral Scott was perplexed. Bogeys? That was a term for unidentified aircraft. Were there enemy aircraft around here? In fact, radar was so new that its terminology had not yet been standardized, so the Boise was simply reusing familiar terms. And that bearing of 65 degrees, what was that, true or relative? Normally the bearing is given in term of degrees true, that is, with reference to 0 degrees as true north. The Boise had said relative, but the word was garbled over the radio. A relative bearing, relative as to the one reporting the contact, is meaningless unless one knows the position and course of the one reporting the contact. The true bearing for the Boise's contact was 295 degrees. This worried Admiral Scott. Were his wayward destroyers the reported radar contacts? He could not open fire if he did not know where his ships were. Commodore Tobin was even more worried. His three destroyers were now at about the midpoint of the cruiser column, and directly in the line of fire from the cruisers to these reported radar contacts. With growing alarm, at 11:44, Scott radioed Tobin. Are you taking station ahead? At that time, Tobin was wondering if he should have his ship slow down and simply follow the cruisers and trailing destroyers in column. Tobin inferred that the admiral's question meant he wanted Tobin's destroyers back at the front of the column. After a few seconds of consideration, Tobin responded, Affirmative, coming up on your starboard flank. Certainly the Farenthold was. Tobin assumed he was being followed by the Duncan and Laffey. But the Duncan was having some wacky ideas of her own. Her gunnery radar had picked up the contacts. When the Farenthold slowed down to determine if the rear destroyers were staying in the rear, the Duncan had to slow down to avoid hitting her. Duncan skipper Lieutenant Commander Edmund B. Taylor did not know why the Farenthold had slowed down. Perhaps it was to charge at the Japanese ships that had showed up on the Duncan's fire control radar. It must be because those ships were poised to ambush the Americans as they turned. Not good. So Taylor decided to have the Duncan charge. The little destroyer dashed at 30 knots toward the big Japanese ships to close the range to launch torpedoes, without telling Commodore Tobin, or for that matter, Admiral Scott. As Taylor looked astern, he saw to his horror that no one, not even the Farenthold, was following him. His little ship was charging all by herself. But it was too late to turn back now. It was around this time that the flagship San Francisco, whose fire control radar had been trained in the direction of the contacts, finally detected the incoming ships as well, at the perilously close range of 5,000 yards. Marine Clenroe Davis heard one of the radar operators report by phone to the bridge that unidentified ships had appeared on his display. The man fell silent as he listened to the response of the apparently incredulous officer on the bridge. Then the radar operator politely replied, "Well, sir, these islands are traveling at about 30 knots." Admiral Scott knew the Japanese were here, much, much closer than he would have liked. But he wasn't quite sure where they were, because he wasn't sure where his own destroyers were. Somewhere to starboard and behind him was all he knew. Scott's entire force, entire plan, had been thrown into confusion because his ships could not execute a simple column turn, a maneuver that had slipped through the cracks of the admiral's preparation. After all that determination not to have another Savo Island, all that study, all that training, all that practice, all that effort to keep his ships together, Scott was just like the cruiser captains at Savo Island, afraid to open fire out of fear of hitting his own ships. Admiral Scott was, but his skippers were not. The Boise and Helena had been tracking the Japanese for some 20 minutes. They knew the targets were Japanese. They had good firing solutions. Moreover, as Captain Ernest G. Small of the Salt Lake City later said, it was one of those things that naval officers wait 20 years to see. We crossed their T. The cruiser skippers knew that the U.S. column was perpendicular to, and now less than 3 miles in front of, the Japanese column. That is, the American ships were in a horizontal, capping the Japanese vertical, forming a T. A classic maneuver in which the ships in the cross could fire all of their guns, but the ships in the vertical could respond with only their forward guns. And the admiral didn't seem to realize it. The cross would not last long. They had to take advantage of it, now. Not surprisingly, the Boise and Helena were getting impatient. A lookout on the Helena reported, "Ships visible to the naked eye." This announcement prompted a disgusted ensign to grumble to the navigator, "What are we going to do, board them?" It was rather odd, the impatience to open fire, because Admiral Scott's original orders for how to handle this engagement had said the cruisers were to open fire without his permission, but it seems none of the skippers were comfortable in doing so. The Helena skipper, Captain Hoover, decided to press the issue, which brought to the forefront what was in retrospect a bizarre quirk of the General Signals Procedure Book. Over the voice radio, specifically the talk between ship circuit, Hoover sent to Admiral Scott a two-word message, interrogatory Roger. According to the signals procedure, this was to be interpreted as a request for permission to commence action, in this instance, request permission to open fire. If the response was Roger, then the permission had been granted. What Admiral Scott's people on the San Francisco heard in these same words, though, also according to signals procedure, was, "Did you receive my last message?" This was the Helena's report of a radar contact. In that instance, a response of Roger means, "I have received your message." The flagship responded by voice radio, "Roger." It's not clear if the Helena actually received this response. In the light cruiser's radio room, Lieutenant C.G. Morris interpreted the response from Admiral Scott to be, "Wait, which does not fit the context for Roger. But with time to spring their surprise slipping away, Captain Hoover quickly tried again. Interrogatory Roger. This time the San Francisco's reply was heard loud and clear. Roger. Lieutenant W.D. Fisher, the Helena's signal officer, shouted to Captain Hoover, "Permission granted." Finally, the Helena's skipper snarled, "Open fire!" And at 11:46 p.m., 5 minutes after Commander Yokota's I-26, unable to get into attack position, sent a too-late-to-be-of-use warning of the cruiser's presence, the 15-6-inch guns of the Helena, which had been loaded for a half hour, boomed and boomed in the night. Within a minute, the Salt Lake City chipped in with 10 8-inch shells. At about the same time, the Boise sent another 15 6-inch shells. Not wanting to be left out, the San Francisco joined in as well. The Duncan's Roy Boehm remembered the shock of it. The night erupted. American warships opened up with everything, and a gigantic, continuous explosion of bright flashes and flaming meteors. It was like being in the heart of a violent electrical storm. Star clusters, bursting high aloft, bathed the desperately maneuvering mixture of friendly and enemy ships with eerie shadows and reflections. Streaks of flames belched from every big gun. Like Boehm, Admiral Scott was shocked. He had given no specific order to open fire. Were his cruisers firing on his destroyers? It sure seemed that way. Lieutenant Morris called it one of the most dramatic misinterpretations of signals in naval history. The largest and closest of the Japanese ships, Aoba, was snowed under by an avalanche of gunfire from the Boise, Salt Lake City, Fahrenholt, and Laffey. It was probably one of the Boise shells that wrecked the Aoba's bridge and fatally injured Admiral Goto. With their fearless and perhaps clueless leader incapacitated, the bombardment group followed Goto's last order to turn around and then sluggishly milled around in confusion, with the only objective being to get out. The Helena's main battery aimed at two different but unspecified targets. One was apparently the Hatsuyuki on the port wing of the Japanese formation. The other target seems to have been the Duncan, who had gotten way too close to the Japanese, passing the Aoba in the opposite direction. The Laffey, seeing the Helena open fire, decided to drop back and try to fall in behind the trailing destroyer McCalla. Her skipper, Lieutenant Commander William E. Hank, understandably wanted no part of being caught in the crossfire between the Japanese and his own ships. "Cease firing! Our ships!" shouted Admiral Scott into the voice radio. He was very concerned that his cruisers, who had been firing for only some 90 seconds, were firing on the lost destroyers of Destroyer Squadron 12. But no one stopped firing. Scott repeated his order. Then the Salt Lake City ceased fire. Scott physically went up to the San Francisco's navigation bridge to personally order Captain McMorris to stop shooting. The Boise and Helena? Well, they never stopped firing, so they evidently did not get the order. Evidently. Admiral Scott got on the voice radio to Commodore Tobin. "How are you?" the Admiral asked. "Destroyer Squadron 12 is okay," Tobin answered. To be more precise, Tobin and his ship Fahrenholt were okay. He had no idea where the Duncan and Laffey had gone or what had happened to them, though he didn't tell his Admiral that. "Were we shooting at you?" Scott asked. A befuddled Tobin replied, "I did not know who you were firing at." Completely frustrated, the Admiral ordered, "All Squadron 12 turn on recognition signals." 4 of the 5 destroyers lit up their recognition lights, white and colored lights arranged in the sequence that changes by day, mounted on the side of the bridge. Ominously, the lone destroyer that did not was the Duncan. Of the 4 that did, only 2, the Buchanan and McCalla, were where they were supposed to be. With that settled, at least as much as it was going to be, at 11:51, Admiral Scott barked into the voice radio, "Commence firing! Commence firing!" The confusion caused by the botched column turn and the Duncan's charge had given the Japanese 4 minutes to gather themselves and try to escape. One of those ships showed a very big return on the radars of the San Francisco and Salt Lake City. Both cruisers snapped on their searchlights and pinned their target, which showed a white band on one of her smokestacks. The U.S. Navy never used such recognition symbols. The ship was obviously Japanese. Admiral Scott was shocked to see a Japanese ship so close, only some 1,400 yards away. But at least now he was certain the targets were not American ships, at least not this target. This was the destroyer Fubuki, who had been holding position on the starboard beam of Admiral Goto's flagship Aoba. The destroyer had given an outsized radar return because she had been in the process of reversing course to starboard, thus presenting her port broadside and largest possible profile to the radar. The American 8-inch cruisers let the Fubuki have it, joined by many of Admiral Scott's other ships. The Japanese destroyer had Allied blood on her hands. It had been she who first spotted and reported the aforementioned Perth and Houston off northwest Java as they tried to escape the Japanese in the East Indies, helping to sink both. Now the bill was due. Fubuki Captain Lieutenant Commander Yamashita Shizuo seems to have still been in shock, or else shared Admiral Goto's belief that he was the victim of friendly fire, for the destroyer never fired a shot or even trained out any of her tubes carrying the deadly Type 93 torpedoes as she tried to scurry away. Japanese records claim the Fubuki received 4 hits. The Americans believe the actual figure was much higher. Whatever it was, and 4 8-inch shell hits would be a serious issue for any destroyer, the Fubuki did not last long. The avalanche of American arms caused an explosion aboard the Revolutionary destroyer that sent her to the depths at 11:53, barely 6 minutes after the shooting began, taking with her Yamashita and about half her crew. Near the Fubuki was the Fahrenhold, still trying to get back to the front of the American column and almost there, being even with the San Francisco to port. Also to port was whoever smacked the Fahrenhold with at least 2 hits, both on the port side, one jamming the torpedo mount, the other at the waterline, destroying the plotting room and disrupting all power, lighting, and communications in the forward part of the ship. The Fahrenhold developed a heavy list to port, and Commodore Tobin looked to exit this particular stage. Like the Fubuki, the Aoba was still completing her turn to starboard. She had several fires burning, and her foremast had been toppled, but she gamely fired back with her aft 8-inch turret, the only one still operational. On the navigation bridge, Captain Hisamune tried to steer an erratic course to throw off the vicious gunfire, but it was not enough to keep the aft turret from being destroyed by an explosion and fire after only 7 shots. Only Hisamune's order for the cruiser to make smoke brought her some relief and a chance to escape. Behind the Aoba in the Japanese cruiser column was the Furutaka under Captain Araki Tsutao. Araki saw what was happening to the Aoba ahead of him, and determined the situation was not good. With the American column having crossed their T from left to right, Araki guessed that a left turn would enable him to more quickly return fire with his entire battery and take his ship out of the main line of fire. The Furutaka started turning left. Then he saw the Aoba in deep trouble, so he turned right to try to take some of the heat off of his flagship, and he did, for a price. After she fired one salvo from her secondary battery at 11:48, the Furutaka started taking the avalanche of gunfire, especially from the Salt Lake City. It was apparently a salvo from the Salt Lake City that, a minute later, smashed the Furutaka's aft 8-inch turret. At 11:51, as the old Japanese cruiser was in the midst of her turn and parallel to the American column, a shell exploded on the port torpedo tubes, igniting several of the Type 93 torpedoes there, and starting a large fire that now served as a nice point of aim in the darkness. As the Furutaka turned to starboard, she was being stalked by destroyer Duncan, the one ship Navy, as C.W. Kilpatrick cheekily named her. Lieutenant Commander Taylor ordered hard to starboard to try to get out of the American line of fire, but then he saw the Furutaka and swung left again to try for a good firing solution. The destroyer's 5-inch guns got in some good licks on the cruiser's superstructure and launched one torpedo, but as Roy Boehm described it, in the middle of the storm, Duncan found herself occupying a precarious no-man's land between the guns of the enemy and the guns of her own ships. Alone and trapped between enemy and friendly guns, Duncan became a lightning rod attracting fire from both sides, especially from the Furutaka, the Hatsuyuki, and, Boehm believed, the Boise. The Duncan was walloped between the number 2 5-inch mount and the bridge, starting a serious fire. Another shell collapsed the smokestack. Several American shells, believed to be 6-inch, perforated her hull and superstructure. After launching one more torpedo, the Duncan swung away to port, her rudder jammed, burning like a comet. So, for that matter, was the Furutaka. At 11:54, her forward starboard engine room was hit and flooded by an actual American Mark 15 torpedo, probably from the Duncan, though it could have been from a spread of 5 from the Buchanan. A minute later, a shell went into her aft port engine room. At the same time, her main battery got a short near miss on the Salt Lake City at 11:55 that sprayed the American cruiser with shrapnel and also sent a shell into the Boise that torched skipper Captain Edward J. Moran's quarters. Captain Araki's ship got off maybe 30 8-inch shells, But she had to deal with not just the damage, flooding, and loss of speed, but also the humiliation of being the first confirmed hit during the Guadalcanal campaign by an American surface-launched torpedo on an enemy ship. Behind the Furutaka was the Kinugasa. Her skipper, Captain Sawa Masao, was known for being aggressive, but even he wanted no part of what he was seeing up ahead. The wily skipper, like a Furutaka,